This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington, D.C., where if your business doesn't take you near Capitol Hill, the White House, the IMF, or the World Bank, then life and traffic still looks pretty normal. But last weekend's warning that al-Qaeda may plan attacks on several specific buildings has ushered in some changes. Here in Washington, in New York City, and in Newark, New Jersey this week, the streets around some financial and government sites have become tangled with barricades, bomb-sniffing dogs, and security checkpoints. The newly released intelligence is startling in its specificity. Identifying named targets is a big change from the more vague terror warnings and threat matrices we've been told about since 9/11. Some people find reassurance in specifics, yet many questions remain about the age of the information, the intent of the planners, and how targeted cities should respond. There are also questions about the timing of this alert, which leads some to suspect political motives. Later in the program, we'll talk with Alan Cullison of the Wall Street Journal about what he's learned about al-Qaeda from a computer used by Osama bin Laden's right-hand man shortly before the fall of the Taliban in Afghanistan. But first, the chain of events that began with the discovery of another computer, this one in Pakistan, last week. If you have questions about last weekend's orange alert, what's clear about these new threats, what's not, and where that leaves you, give us a phone call. We'd also like to hear from you on how you think the government has handled this information. Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. The email address, TOTN at NPR.org. NPR's national security correspondent Mary Louise Kelly joins us now here in Studio 3. Good to have you back on the program.
Hello, Neil.
Let's go back to the beginning. How and where was this computer found?
Well, the first rumblings we had that something might be going on was last Thursday, late last week, 6 days ago, when we started hearing reports out of Pakistan that officials there had captured Ahmed Khalfan Gilani. He was, this is a man with a $5 million bounty on his head on the FBI's most wanted list, senior al-Qaeda operative, we believe. He does not appear to have been the breakthrough, though. The breakthrough was apparently the detention of someone who most of us here in the U.S., even who follow these things, had not heard of, and whose capture was not announced at the time. This is a man named Muhammad Naeem Noor Khan. He's Pakistani in his 20s. Not clear that he is was that senior in al-Qaeda, but believed to be a computer expert. And he had files on his computer, drawings, documents, maps that have since been combed through by U.S. officials and which appear to have been the major thrust that led to these terrorist threat warnings coming over the weekend.
Now, from what we know of these files, and they've not exactly been emailed to the media, but from what we know of these files, they are security plans on various buildings here in the United States, some in Britain as well, that appear to give a blueprint on how to go about attacking these buildings.
I think the alarming thing about them has been the nature of detail and specificity. They document what time security guards come in, what things they're wearing, side entrances through which you might get access, where employees from specifically these five buildings in Newark, Washington, and New York City congregate after work, all sorts of details showing that there was an incredible amount of surveillance that went on. Some of these are publicly available documents, maps that anyone could download off the net. Other things, clearly somebody at some point was standing outside and around these buildings for a long period of time scouting them out.
And pictures as well. And we're told these documents are written in very good English.
We're told that as well, that that's one of the notable things, that there are no grammatical errors. They're written in perfect English by someone who's either a native speaker or who clearly spent a long amount of time speaking English inside the U.S.
Now, the next question comes in the story. This information comes from Pakistan to the United States over the weekend. It's discussed by a group which I'd not heard before, and that's the 5 o'clock committee. Tell us that.
Apparently first discussed last Thursday. This is a meeting that originally was started by George Tenet, the former head of the CIA and director of Central Intelligence. The practice has been carried on by the now acting director of the CIA, John McLaughlin. Every day, every weekday, 5 o'clock, at the CIA headquarters, they chair a meeting that includes representatives from the FBI, the NSA, all the relevant agencies. They come together, share information, try to figure out what the major things they need to chase up are, and that becomes the basis of the president's briefing first thing the next morning. We're told that last Thursday, that was the first time they, were going through this information. And we're also told that it is corroborated by another stream of information that made them take this very, very seriously indeed, that they already had some warnings that something was going on around this time period, perhaps in New York. And they took it very seriously. The news was then relayed to the president Friday morning. We're told there were meetings at the White House all over the weekend. The CIA was scrambling all through the weekend, and the decision was finally reached that on Sunday, as we now know, Tom Ridge, the Homeland Security Secretary, would come out and announce we're raising the threat level.
Now, who makes that decision? Is that Tom Ridge who makes that decision, or is that the President of the United States?
Ultimately, the President weighs in on that, and apparently he did weigh in Sunday morning and give the go-ahead. He is, of course, advised by all sorts of people, including Tom Ridge at Homeland Security, including the CIA. He has close advisors on his national security team in the White House.
Now, this other stream of information that came into it, what do we know about that? I mean, I guess there's been a generalized, maybe it's an assumption or maybe it's intelligence, belief that Al-Qaeda wants to do something in the time frame of the conventions to the election.
I think it's a number of things, and we certainly wish we knew more about it than we do. There has apparently been just sort of general chatter, as it's called, that's been picked up, leading U.S. officials to think that something might be happening that might try to influence the election. We were told just a few moments ago this afternoon by Fran Townsend, who is the president's advisor on Homeland Security. She works out of the West Wing of the White House. She confirmed that there was a distinct second stream of information that indicated something might be up specifically in August or September, and that also appeared to point to the threat of attack on New York. This was apparently something that they were just learning about late last week as well. And so it was apparently these two things converging that made them take it very seriously. This information coming off a computer in Pakistan, and then this other separate stream of apparently very current information coming in.
So Secretary Ridge then announces the terror alerts just around these specific buildings on Sunday afternoon. On Monday, the president holds a news conference of sort in the Rose Garden, where he's specifically talking about proposals by the 9/11 Commission and how his endorsement or partial endorsement of some of those.
That's right.
But he's asked questions about some of these events. Then that afternoon, it becomes clear that a lot of this information on this computer that was found in Pakistan is 2 to 3 years old.
At least 2 to 3 years old, possibly up to 4 years old. We're told that much of it dates from 2000 or 2001. Also told that at least one file was opened as recently as this January, so this year. We don't know, however, if that was just somebody opening it because they were cleaning out their computer or whether they were opening it to do something with it. We don't know that. The president, as you say, came out in the Rose Garden. At this point, reporters were not aware that the information was old, so he did not field particularly tough questions about that. He came out and said, look, we feel like it's in the public's interest to put out there what we know. Since then, there's been a lot of criticism that if they wanted to put out there what they knew, why didn't they tell everyone that it was 3 or 4 years old? Again, Fran Townsend, the White House senior official, when we put that question to her this afternoon, said, we didn't put it out there because it wasn't relevant. This information was so specific, so detailed. It dovetailed with other intelligence we had coming in. The fact that it was old does not make it irrelevant. We know, she says, Al-Qaeda plans things years in advance. We know September 11th was hardly a spur-of-the-moment operation.
5 years in the making.
Yes, 5 years in the making as well, apparently, for the bombings of U.S. embassies in Africa back in 1998. We know that Al-Qaeda was working on that in the early 90s, years before they actually happened. So she says the fact that the surveillance was going on, that we don't know how recently it was going on, perhaps a lot of this information is a few years old, doesn't mean the plans weren't active. On the other hand, doesn't mean they were. We don't know.
So whether it's a defunct or ongoing plot is unclear. Interesting that Mr. Ghalani, whose capture started this whole chain of events, he is allegedly involved in the bombings of the U.S. embassies in East Africa that were planned years in advance.
A tangled web.
One thing that goes on, though, is this story of, hey, this is old information, lasts for about a news cycle, and then intelligence sources tell various reporters, wait a minute, there's this other stream of information.
Well, it's this. I think it's this dilemma that that senior officials are really wrestling with how much to put out there. I think, to give them the benefit of the doubt, I think they actually, are looking at what they're calling a treasure trove of incredibly detailed information.
Not just this computer. There's documents that they see as well.
Documents, photographs, maps. They want to put it out there and be able to warn local officials and the building officials and the people they worked there, hey, be on the lookout. Something might be up. But it is. It's if you're trying to sort of manage a message and retain credibility, it's difficult to have news cycle after news cycle more things leaking out. And suddenly now we're hearing they have all this, perhaps a second stream of intelligence that corroborates the first. But why didn't we know that when all of this came out originally? It's a very difficult thing as they try to weigh how much to tell people and try terms of trying to tell people to look out without not wanting to tip your hand to the terrorists and reveal so much about what you've got and how you got it that everything all is revealed and sources and methods are compromised.
Our telephone number, if you'd like to join the conversation, 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Email is TOTN@NPR.org. Let's talk with Chip, who's on the phone with us from St. Augustine, Florida.
Thanks for having me.
Sure.
She kind of touched on some of the things I was going to say. The timing seems a little strange, plus the fact that they tipped their hands to the terrorists. Why didn't they keep this a little close to the vest, warn the people that were in the buildings and the affected areas, and then catch the guys red-handed or something? It just smacks of political maneuvering or something.
Chip is not the only person to make this suggestion. Indeed, on Morning Edition a couple of days ago, Larry Johnson, a former CIA analyst, says, "Look, you've just given Al Qaeda information on how we respond to things. That may have been their intention."
Yeah, they were so worried about, we want to give enough information to warn people. We don't want to tip our hands. It's on the front page. I imagine they read the paper.
If I can weigh in here, I suspect, just to give what sort of the administration response would be, one of White House official was telling us today, raising an alert, putting this out there buys you some time. We don't know whether putting all of this out there, in fact, causes them to accelerate their plans or causes them to abandon it altogether, thinking, all right, security will now be too stiff. We don't know, but perhaps it buys some time in terms of closing gaps.
Thanks, Chip.
Thank you very much.
Let's get another caller in if we can. Tom is on the line from Annapolis, Maryland.
I just wanted to thank you all for adding the perspective from the fact that just because the intelligence is old does not make it irrelevant. As you mentioned, these other major operations were years in the making. And, I'm very sensitive to the current political climate right now because I'm a former journalist and I've had a lot of friends accuse the liberal media of having bias. But it's great to hear that all parts of the story are being considered, that yes, some people on the left might have used that fact to criticize the right, to say, oh, it was just political. But I'm glad to hear that the age of the information and the perspective that gives on the nature of these operations is part of the consideration of what people should take away from the importance of the story.
And Mary Louise, a key element of the story, as Tom suggests.
Absolutely. Being able to put this into perspective is I think what we're all trying to do.
Tom, thanks very much for the phone call. We appreciate it.
Thank you. Take care.
Mary Louise Kelly, thank you so much for being with us this afternoon. Mary Louise Kelly, NPR's national security correspondent, here with us in Studio 3A. Well, obviously, there are different perspectives about how well the government has handled this information. We're going to continue talking about that when we come back from a break. Again, if you'd like to join us, the phone number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. The email address is TOTN@NPR.org. What do you think of the way that the government has handled this situation thus far? And how do we keep terrorism from becoming a political football in an election year? I'm Neil Conan. More on that after the break. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're talking about terrorism alerts issued for three cities on the East Coast this past Sunday. Does having such specific information ease your mind or increase your concern? We'd like to hear from you wherever you live. Our number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. The email address is totn@npr.org. With us here in Studio 3A is NPR National Security Correspondent Mary Louise Kelly. And joining us now is Michael Greenberger. He's director of the Center for Health and Homeland Security at the University of Maryland. He joins us from Baltimore, Maryland. We're talking about now the Department of Homeland Security and how all of this information has been handled. Good of you to be with us today, sir.
Good to be here.
So what do you think of how this information has been dispensed thus far?
Well, let me say that in terms of the tactics and strategy that was the ultimate outcome of Sunday's press conference by Secretary Ridge, I am in agreement with the fact that the alert level needed to be raised and raised in a surgical way that only dealt with the five buildings that were involved in New York, Northern New Jersey, and D.C., where I think we ran into a lot of trouble is that it was not made clear on Sunday the details about the source of the information and the extent to which it was dated from 3 to 4 years ago. I think most people left that conference, including, unfortunately, I think some of the mayors and police commissioners that were left to devise plans in conjunction with the federal government, believing that we were dealing with information that was fresher than it was and which was pointing toward the possibility of an imminent attack. The fact that 48 hours later it had to be made clear that the information was, at least the basic thrust of the information, was 3 to 4 years old, required everybody to do a lot of rethinking. It's very clear, for example, the mayor of D.C. and the police commissioner in D.C. and the mayor of Newark are quite upset because the way the information was conveyed to them that made them believe they had to put on a kind of full-court press that is quite expensive, drains resources of jurisdictions that are already in serious financial trouble. And I believe, you know, raises the psyche of the American people unnecessarily.
And they're now facing the dilemma of, well, when do you stop?
Well, yes, they're facing the dilemma of when do you stop. But a lot of the things that have been put in motion are really right now uncontrollable. For example, in D.C., the Capitol Police Force has now launched into a major protection of the perimeter of the Capitol that has closed down critical streets in the District of Columbia and is leading to traffic jams and all other sorts of dislocations. Of course, the Capitol was always a target, but was not a focus of the alert system that went into effect on Sunday. So there are many, many aspects of this that have sort of gotten out of control and are difficult to put back in the box. And the question is, with the administration now reshaping what its message is, and that is an understandable reshaping, the message is that, yes, this is old information, but it may have been updated. And in any event, Al-Qaeda plans way in advance for these attacks, and so there's no need to let down or be dissuaded by the importance of it. Well, that's coming 48 hours after the fact, and people are just generally, whether they're regular citizens or first responders, in a high state of confusion right now.
Let's get a caller involved in the conversation. Mary Ann is with us from Napa, California.
Hi, how are you?
Very well, thanks.
I have two words for this administration: come clean. If they would just give us all the information up front, let us know the information's old when they put it out there, there would be no controversy. There would be nothing for anyone to come back at them with, just like the weapons of mass destruction.
Well, Mary Louise, when you talk to people at the White House and you say, why didn't you put this information out before, they said they thought it wasn't relevant?
They say they really think it was not relevant, that it was very specific, it was very detailed. As we just were talking about a moment ago, we hear that Al-Qaeda cases things years in advance and then decides when it's ready to go ahead with a plan. One senior White House official just told NPR a couple of hours ago, it's hardly like we were intentionally holding this back. Maybe, you know, next time I guess we've learned our lesson, we would put it out there. We would put the dates out there. It just was not at the top of our agenda because it was just such urgent and compelling and chilling information.
Michael Greenberger, as I'm sure people know, Howard Dean, the former governor of Vermont and the former presidential candidate, is among those who've said, boy, the timing of this right after the Democratic convention sounds a little politically convenient to him. And does the way the administration has handled this, does that open them to these kinds of charges?
It certainly opens them to these kinds of charges. I think it's interesting that the Sunday when Governor Dean made those comments, he was quickly stomped on not only by Republicans but by Senator Lieberman and implicitly by Senator Kerry. But then when the information came out 48 hours later that this was 3 to 4 years old, it sort of lent credibility to his criticism, and now it's sort of an open discussion, or at least if people aren't convinced one way or the other, they're scratching their heads about this. I think the secretary also aggravated the situation by saying the intelligence behind this alert was, quote, the result of the president's leadership on the war on terror, close quote, which is what he said on Sunday. And I think those kinds of statements really do play into the hands of those people who believe this is all part of the campaign rather than an honest and independent assessment. And I think as it was said previously, a lot of lessons learned come out of this, and I don't think you'll see that kind of hype involved in future alerts. But the fact of the matter is we are now 34 months out from September 11th, and it's very late in the game for us to be learning how to inform the American people and to say, well, on this sixth most major announcement we've made affecting the color alert system, we're still learning lessons and we'll do better next time.
Well, Marianne, thanks very much for the phone call.
Thank you.
And Michael Greenberger, we appreciate your time today.
You're welcome.
Michael Greenberger joined us from Baltimore, where he directs the Center for Health and Homeland Security at the University of Maryland. And joining us now from his office in Alexandria, Virginia, is retired Colonel Randall Larson, CEO of Homeland Security Associates. And it's good of you to join us today.
Good afternoon, Neil.
And I wonder, do you have a different view of the way Homeland Security has handled this situation over the past several days?
Well, yes. I spent time working in the intelligence community during my 32 years of government service, and you know, understanding how the process works is certainly understandable how this happened. There were several, as your reporter said, there were several bits of information coming in. It was not just this computer with the pictures of these buildings. There was a lot of chatter, a lot of things going on. A specific individual was arrested, said we're going to hit New York and Washington soon. So when they put those things together, I mean, if I was in this position, I would have done the same thing as Tom Ridge. However, remember, what Tom Ridge says did not direct the mayor of any of these cities to do anything, or the Capitol police chief up there that's put all these new security precautions around Capitol Hill. Those decisions were made down at that level. I can't imagine anything else that Tom Ridge could have done with that information.
Well, it's interesting. As we mentioned earlier, some of the sites on this computer were not just in the United States. There were some British sites, or at least one British site as well. The British government has handled this very differently.
And if a bomb goes off in that building, they will have a lot of explaining to do when it's over. You could say, though, the Brits have a lot more experience at this back, you know, a couple decades ago with the IRA bombing campaign. I'm sure there's lessons we can learn from them. The one good offshoot I see from this is that several reports came out in the last couple of weeks, one from the Red Cross and another from a polling agency, I don't remember, that said the American public is not psychologically prepared for the next set of attacks. That will cause serious problems. One thing, I think we have heightened the awareness. Everyone thinks there's a high probability we'll have attacks in the next few months. I think the American people are more aware of that possibility right now. Being psychologically prepared will help us recover much quicker.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a good thing out of it. But I tell you what, it's had they not taken these actions and something would have happened, they would have been in the administration, the Department of Homeland Security would have been in far more trouble.
Yes, if this had come, you know, it's hard to draw analogies.
Mm-hmm.
If this had happened in the Clinton administration right after a Republican convention, suspicions would have been raised.
I think so, but do we hear, in the heated political campaign, there's going to be, you know, suspicions, and that's just understandable as part of the system here. It's just hard to imagine how they could have sat on this information. And the fact that it was a few years old, the people dealing with that in the intelligence community, and you've stated it quite correctly several times here,
mm-hmm.
that they spend years planning things. So the fact that it was some of the information was dated. We know a building that I worked in a couple of years ago here in Arlington, we discovered that Al-Qaeda was casing that. Well, one of our cleaning people said, hey, a guy was taking pictures here late last night asking if military people work here. Is there underground parking? When we reported that to the FBI and the Arlington police, they said, we get these reports every day, people taking pictures, doing stuff. There's been a lot of buildings here on the East Coast cased by Al-Qaeda. But the fact that they made this very specific to those buildings, I think, shows that a maturity. Remember, the last five times we went orange for the whole nation, and this time it's been much more limited. I think that shows a maturing process in our alert and warning system, even though we still have a lot more to learn.
Colonel Larson, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Randall Larson is CEO of the consulting firm Homeland Security Associates, and he joined us from his home in Virginia. And, let's move along. The day-to-day inconvenience of these terror alerts is felt mostly by those here in Washington, in New York, and in Newark, New Jersey, where commutes now suddenly involve checkpoints and roadblocks, at least some of them. But the psychological impact is something the whole country gets to share. Joining us now from Trenton, New Jersey, is David Ropick. He's Director of Risk Communication at the Harvard Center for Risk Analysis, and welcome to the program.
Neil, thanks for having me to a fascinating discussion.
Well, as we've been talking about, this alert, far more specific than past alerts. Is that more reassuring to people psychologically, or is that, certainly leads people in some locales to get more nervous?
One of the things that risk communication literature, scientists who have studied this sort of thing, suggest is to reduce uncertainty as much as possible. The more uncertain we are, the more afraid we are. Think about the sniper in Washington, D.C., when a lot of educated people of both political parties were terrified, even though they knew the risk to them was infinitesimal. But it was the not knowing any of the details that made it so scary. So previous code oranges, et cetera, have been so vague that some of the feedback has been, boy, you guys have to share more of the details when you can. You don't give away means and so forth of how your intelligence is gathered.
And we should point out that often there's not an opportunity to share details because they don't have them.
That's right. Or it's vague. You know, you hear these guys talking a lot, chatter and so forth, but you don't know. So in that sense, the risk perception, the psychology of risk literature suggests that specificity does two things. It reduces uncertainty, so now people in Kansas aren't as afraid as they might have been. And it also suggests that these guys aren't making it up. They really have some specific thing they're talking about. Now, it's a separate question as to how much they are taking advantage of this politically, and I think they are some, but my general sense is there is really something up, and they really do feel like being open and honest is the right way to go. Compare that, for example, to having this information and not telling us, and you found out on NPR, let's say. But it also, by being specific, increases trust that they're on the ball doing something and that there is some legitimate kernel to a threat here in the alert.
We're talking about the most recent terror alerts on the East Coast of the United States, and our guest is David Ropick of Risk Communication at the Harvard Center for Risk Analysis, and also, of course, Mary Louise Kelly from NPR. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And let's get a caller on the line. Jane is with us from Andover, Vermont.
Yes, hi. I'm calling because I was kind of excited to hear your news story today. I heard the reports on Sunday, and I was very, very upset because I have a daughter that's in New York, and we also lost a family member 9/11.
Mm-hmm.
And I called her immediately and told her to get out of the city. I left her a message, just get out. You know, I just didn't want her there. And then on Monday, I heard a news report that Barbara, Laura, and Jenna Bush were all at Wall Street to show their support for New York. And once I heard that report, I really started to have my doubts about the seriousness of this. Because I know that at 9/11, they protected all these people. They had them in bunkers. And I couldn't imagine that he would send his wife, his mother, and his daughter to an area that was supposedly threatened. Anyway, that's my comment.
Okay, Jane. Thanks very much.
You're welcome.
Bye. And Jane, by the way,
yeah.
Very sorry for your loss.
Oh,
sir.
Thank you.
Yeah, appreciate
yeah.
it. Right, bye-bye.
Bye.
Well, you're going to get all kinds of reactions, David Ropick.
A number of them. First of all, Jane, I have a daughter who works and lives in New York, and that was my first thought as well, and I lost a close friend on one of the planes. So I absolutely understand your feelings. I will tell you that the people who have studied the psychology of risk find that we are all, as humans, more afraid of a risk that threatens children, especially our own, than the very same risk to ourselves. So that's just one way that we react to risks. In general, perhaps you might have had a somewhat different reaction were you, as opposed to your daughter in New York. Clearly, the facts on 911, there were planes in the air, we were confused, we didn't know what was going on, made the threat more urgent than they sense is currently the case in New York. And clearly, there are probably some advantages and political advantages, both, to communicating it that way. One is, look, we're asking you people to go about living your lives, maybe be a little bit more alert, but the average risk to even people in New York or Washington is low. They have to kind of put their money where their mouth is. So that's why Laura Bush and her children or the president sometimes travels to risky zones. And also, it's a photo op. Let's be honest. I think the political side of this has been overplayed, and mostly they're trying to do the right things, but there's some of that in there, and that's probably why they were there as well.
Let's see if we can squeeze one more caller in. Tenzin is with us from Buffalo, New York.
Hi, thanks for your show.
Thank you.
I was listening to Mr. Larson speak and couldn't help but feel fear from what he was saying, and that's the whole thing. I was living overseas for 10 years, and I came back 6 months after 9/11, and I couldn't believe the fear that was felt through everybody in this country when in all third world countries, people are feeling like this all the time. And the point that I want to make is that what I'm feeling right now is more fear about what this government is going to do than what terrorists are going to do. I feel like this is becoming more of a government that wants to take control by means other than the democratic process. In other words, doesn't this all feel like it's leading up to some kind of coup action or something?
Well,
Tenzin, let me jump in here, David, here.
And you have to keep it short, David.
I will. The greater fear, I think, is the terror, not the terrorism. It is hard to measure scientifically, but entirely plausible to suggest that the dangers that come from people being too afraid of a relatively low risk to the average American,
right,
the stress that they suffer, the dangerous choices they make to buy guns or to drive instead of fly or take Cipro when they don't need it,
exactly,
to give up their personal choices, all of them, including yours, Tenzin,
mm-hmm,
may be more dangerous to you than the risks of terrorism themselves. So I argue that no matter what you think the government may be up to try and keep it in perspective in your life for your own and your every listener's personal health.
Understood.
Thanks for the call.
Thank you.
And David Ropick, we appreciate your time today.
Neil, thanks for having me.
David Ropick, co-author of Risk, A Practical Guide for Deciding What's Really Safe and What's Really Dangerous in the World Around You, director of risk communication at Harvard. He joined us from Trenton, New Jersey. When we come back from a short break, from baby pictures to snippy emails, a look into the digital life of Al-Qaeda. Mary Louise Kelly, thank you for joining us. I'm Neil Conan. It's NPR News.